Okay, we're ready to go? Okay. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming and welcome. I'm Cheryl Alcon, and this is Lori Edwards, and we are talking about writing health books. And we have a handout that I had put some at the front, but if you haven't gotten a handout and we're still talking, just come up and talk to us at the end, and we can give you a handout. Let me just think. Okay, so I'm Cheryl Alcon. I'm the author of a book called Balancing Pregnancy with Pre-Existing Diabetes, and it's a book I wrote because when I was trying to get pregnant, I was looking for a resource and, excuse me, couldn't find one. So I felt eventually I had to write one. So that is essentially what I'm here to talk about. And Lori will introduce herself as well.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. Thanks for coming. Quick reminder, because I just did it myself, turn off your cell phones if you haven't. obligatory public service announcement. But thank you so much for coming. As Cheryl said, I am Lori Edwards. I wrote two books on chronic illness. First book came out in 2008. It's called Life Disrupted, Getting Real About Chronic Illness in Your 20s and 30s. And my second book just came out this past spring, In the Kingdom of the Sick, A Social History of Chronic Illness in America. So very different books, very different audiences, which we'll jump into in a second. But I got my MFA here at Emerson College in Boston in 2006. Go Emerson. And I now teach writing for the health sciences at Northeastern. So when I'm not writing books. So we're going to go through some main discussion topics, and then we have saved room at the end for Q&A. So we both love to talk and answer questions. So hopefully you guys brought some with you. So the very first thing that we're going to talk about, and it's the most important, everything starts from there, is identifying your audience and then determining what makes your story different. It's all about audience, audience, audience. So, you know, from my first book, I was actually an accidental nonfiction writer. I was at Emerson in the fiction program, and the beginning of my first semester here was in a nonfiction book workshop where everyone else had a book project and I didn't. So I said, okay, I have to write 30 pages in 2 weeks. What am I going to say? So I started writing about being a sick kid. I had grown up in and out of hospitals. I'm a lifelong patient with a respiratory condition. And then as I started writing, I realized that there was really no one else writing about what it was like to be 23 and sick, what it was like to grow up as a sick child and then become an adult, and then also what it was like to navigate all those rites of passage of your 20s as someone who had chronic illness. So that was really my first audience. And what made my first book distinct is that nobody else was doing that. So even though I knew I had a very small niche audience, that's what really worked in my favor, because none of the books on chronic illness that were out there at the time were talking about people in their 20s and 30s. In contrast, my second book is a big picture book. It's a big idea book. Much broader audience, so I wasn't writing strictly to patients, I wasn't writing to a specific age. I was writing for anyone really interested in health, and certainly patients are going to be part of that, but I sort of had in my head the average person who gets in their car and drives to work listening to NPR, and that was kind of my audience. So you're interested in gender, you're interested in public health, and so my books are kind of polar opposites in that respect, but it was really what makes them different. And for my second book, the real distinguisher was that nobody had written about chronic illness as a whole before. We'd seen Siddhartha Mukherjee's The Emperor of Maladies, which is a really wonderfully written book about cancer, or Melanie Thernstrom's The Pain Chronicles, which really took chronic pain and stretched it out. But nobody had looked at chronic illness. And with 133 million Americans suffering with it, I felt like it was time. So that's really how I positioned it, was that it was the first book to look, the first social history to look at the umbrella term of chronic illness.
And for my book, basically, as I had said, I was looking for information when I was trying to get pregnant with my first child, and I'm a lifelong person with diabetes, and, you know, found some resources, but they were either really basic or really, you know, scary and telling you, like, all the terrible things that could happen. And I was like, I know that people with diabetes have children, and I know it's not all scary. You know, where is this resource? So, and as I said, like, I felt I had to write it. So what I did was try to figure out why there was no book about this, and I learned that, pregnant women with diabetes is kind of a niche of a niche topic. So in terms of trying to find a publisher, I really had to come up with statistics to show like how many people out there would actually benefit from a book like mine. So in the example that I give is that, you know, if you can say, well, there's 26 million people with diabetes and they're growing, you know, it's a terrible public health issue, but it's actually great for a person who wants to write a book about diabetes because you can show that there's actually a growing audience for, you know, for your, you know, for that particular topic. So for me, I just tried to basically, you know, explain why I needed a book, you know, why a book like this was needed. And that it needed to be something positive and like interviewing other people with diabetes, not just doctors talking to, you know, patients. So, you know, basically what I did was I went on Amazon and I saw what books were selling about pregnancy with diabetes and I read them all. And, you know, it's easy to go to the library and, you know, take what you need. And then I, you know, helped when I decided to, you know, write a book proposal, I took notes on these books that I read to show like what they did and what I could do better. So, and that actually, and we'll talk about writing a book proposal later, that, you know, was really like a very important point to say, you know, why a kind of book like this is needed. And, you know, it's just giving you more information on how you can, you know, sell a publisher or an agent on your book. Let me just see what else. Oh, and were you going to talk about self-publishing?
Yeah, and we're not going to spend too much time on self-publishing. It's not our area of expertise, but, you know, I do know that there are some topics and there are some writers who are really good fit for that in the health sphere. And if you guys have more questions about whether that's right for you, maybe we can talk in the Q&A. But, you know, I know one patient, e-patient Dave DeBroncart, for example, who has written a wonderful kind of a workbook called Let Patients Help. And it's all about collaboration and communication in healthcare and patient engagement and empowerment. And he did write it as sort of a workbook. And for him, you know, it wasn't going to have mass market appeal. It wasn't something that really worked for a traditional publisher. So he did end up going the self-publishing route and really started approaching hospitals and they were buying it in bulk. So that it's a very different type of book, but, you know, there's certainly room for that in the health sphere. So if you're someone who's wondering if maybe that is a way to go, you know, we can certainly speak to that later. Mm-hmm.
And the thing, too, is that self-publishing today is much more, I think, mainstream than it was even, like, say, 5 years ago. And there are other diabetes writers that I know that are choosing to go the self-publishing route just because if you do have kind of a niche topic and you might be already really active in the social media and you know, kind of know who your audience is going to be, if you're willing to take on the work yourself of, you know, of sort of writing and publishing and marketing, you know, self-publishing gives you an opportunity to do that and then you collect all the royalties or, excuse me, all the profits from that versus going a more traditional route where an agent and, you know, publisher, you know, they all take a cut. So it's something to think about. And then, so our next topic is about building platform. And platform is really key, no matter what kind of book you're trying to write or sell. If you want to go the traditional publishing route, a publisher or an agent will want to know what your platform is. And your platform is like who your people are, like who your audience is going to be and how you've already connected with those people. So what I did, and this was back in 2005 when not everybody was doing it, I started blogging about pregnancy and diabetes just so I could kind of find who my people were out in cyberspace and eventually, you know, develop an audience. So I started blogging anonymously because at the time I was working and didn't need my boss to know what I was doing when I wasn't at work. And frankly, it took me a long time to get pregnant. So the blog kind of grew and it became, eventually became sort of an infertility blog because it was taking me so long. But because of all that time passing, more and more people came to the blog and it was called, it's still around, but it's not really, I'm not blogging anymore, but it was called Managing the Sweetness Within. And it was essentially like a place where other people with diabetes could come and, you know, either give me encouragement or say, oh yeah, I know what it's, you know, I know how tough it is trying to manage blood sugars or, you know, trying to get pregnant. And, you know, this sort of momentum grew. And so I highly recommend if you are just at the beginning stages of coming up with an idea, to start blogging about the topic and get to know who the people are in that space who are blogging about the same topic or writing about similar topics, because those eventually are become, you know, the people that you want to buy your book. What else? Let me just look at my notes really quickly. Twitter now, Facebook pages, you know, Instagram, Pinterest, you know, like there's just so much with social media that you can do to just sort of develop a presence online and get your name out there so that people, you know, kind of associate you with that topic. So then when you do start pulling your book proposal together, you can show a publisher that your platform is established. I think
it's really about building your credibility and establishing yourself as an expert on that, whatever your health topic is, before you even go to a publisher, right? So you've guaranteed that you have an audience. You know that people are interested in this because they're reading your writing and they're commenting on it. And it's really about sort of branding yourself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for my first book, I started this project in 2006, so actually, you know, a lot has changed with social media even since then. But I started, like Cheryl, we actually met through blogging. I started blogging about young adults with chronic illness. And I started gathering clips, even though I didn't usually get paid at the time. It was really worth it to get the bylines. So I wrote for a site called Chronic Babe, for example, which is all about empowering younger women with chronic illness. So those were my people. That was my target audience. And that's how people started coming to my site. I started doing a lot of health and science sort of news articles just so that I was always getting my byline out there so that I had a huge body of work I could show people. And then I actually started writing personal essays that were related to the topics in my first book. And so I got one of those published in the coupling section for the Boston Globe magazine. And that was really helpful for me to be able to say, you know, I was 25 at the time. I didn't have a long, storied career. So what I could do was try to get relevant pieces with my target audience so that I could show a publisher of young, I don't have a lot behind me, but I have my finger on the pulse of something that's really working here. I'm speaking to an audience that no one else is. So one thing to take advantage of is that the social media and online community for health is really robust. Whether it's blogs and Tumblrs to, you know, the New York Times Well blog, and the people are committed and engaged. So take advantage of that. It's really about, you know, building a network and being smart about where you allocate your time. You know, you can't be everywhere and do it well. So for me, you know, I'm not really on Pinterest. I don't do anything with Instagram. My subject doesn't really lend itself to that, but I focus on Twitter or Facebook. I get to know who the thought leaders are in my area, in chronic illness and public health. And then over the years, you nurture relationships and you get invited to speak at things and people will tweet your articles and throw people back to your site. So, you know, it's about authenticity. So, you know, it really does take time, but it's worth it because as we'll see, those networks continue to give back to you. You know, one example I have is Dr. Pauline Chen, who has a doctor-patient column in the New York Times Health section, put a question out on Twitter about how patients feel about doctors on social media. And I just randomly replied to her, and she happened to take it and print it in the New York Times. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. And then that same week, I got a call out of the blue asking me to come to Harlem and meet with President Bill Clinton at the Clinton Foundation and talk about healthcare. And they didn't really say how they found me or why they picked me, but they said that my name came up in social media. So who knows? I mean, you just have to be open to opportunities, but if you cultivate those networks early and you build these relationships, then those are the people that are going to want to read your book and are going to want to post about it, and we'll get into all of that. But it really does pay to take advantage in an authentic way of this really dynamic community that, you know, even when my first big book came out in 2008, wasn't anything like it is now. There's so many more opportunities, so... building your platform is a really good way to position yourself.
You know, and actually, two things that I meant to say. When you are building your platform, you know, as Lori said, because the health community is so robust online, you know, you don't always want to be promoting yourself, even though you do want to be promoting yourself, but it's also good to, like, retweet other people talking about or, you know, writing about the same topics as you. You know, like, if you know somebody else is going to be performing or, you know, speaking at a similar conference, you know, promote their event through Twitter or, you know, mention it through a Facebook update, because then you get known as, you know, someone who's going to give as well as receive. And then two things I had forgot to mention. It's very easy to follow Google News Alerts to just set up news alerts about your topic. You know, if your topic is diabetes and pregnancy or whatever, to set that up as a Google News Alert. So then you'll get an email anytime that topic is being discussed. And, you know, if you do it too broadly, you know, if you just say, diabetes, you know, then you'll get inundated. So, you know, if you don't want to get inundated with that. But it's good to kind of follow what's going on in the news. And also, there's a site called Publishers Marketplace, which I think you put that on, is on our handout. That is a subscription-only site. It's about, it used to be about $20 a month, where you can get information about what books are being published in all genres. And it's a good idea to keep an eye on that, just so you know if there's a book coming out on a similar topic that you don't want them to come out before you, as I did. Or if there's a related topic, then you can say, okay, well, how is that person going to be doing something different than me? Or down the road, could that person be someone who maybe, you know, writes a blurb on the back of my book and can perhaps, you know, help spread the word about my book later on?
Yeah, and so it's sort of a natural transition into writing the book proposal and finding an agent. Because again, it's your platform that's gonna test the waters for you and give you that momentum. So yeah, I was lucky in that I was at Emerson and I was in a class where with Doug Wynot, fabulous nonfiction writer, where he required each of us to do a nonfiction book proposal for our project before we could pass the class. So I was very lucky, but I had that sort of drilled into me. But really take advantage of a well-crafted book proposal. It takes some time, but it is the roadmap for your whole book. And it's really, it's a marketing tool in a lot of ways. And I don't know that writers necessarily get that right away, just how powerful a tool and the analysis can be. So a big part of it in nonfiction, especially with health, is the competitive title analysis. So you want to look at, well, what's already out there and selling well? So how can I capitalize on that? But also, how can I position my book to show that it's different enough that it deserves to be published? And I think health is a good example of that because, you know, 50 million people live with chronic pain, something like that. It's even more. For example, and there are lots of memoirs out there about getting diagnosed, living with chronic pain, the incurable headache, the devastating diagnosis. So if you're someone who you want to write a memoir and you have this story you want to tell, you need to really think about, well, what is out there and why is someone going to buy another book on this? What's going to make mine different? And if you can't answer that question already, then when your agent or your potential publisher asks you that, the game's over. So you really need to position yourself within the marketplace already and really think about how you can make your book proposal and your book project stand out.
And then for, if you don't already know, like a book proposal is essentially like a business plan for your book. So when you're approaching an agent or if you're approaching a publisher directly, you want to have a proposal, a particular nonfiction proposal already written up. So that, you know, we should probably make that clear. If you're writing a nonfiction book, you don't write the book up front, you write the proposal. If you're writing fiction, which we're not really talking about, you write that first. But for the proposal, it's, you know, mine included an introduction, a bio of like who I was and why I was the best person to write the book I wanted to write, the competitive analysis of the other titles, which is really, as Lori and I said, very key, a sample chapter, an outline, which for me was the toughest thing to write and was the last thing I wrote. And I put in like a marketing section of like who I knew in journalism because I'd worked in journalism a long time and who would possibly, you know, promote this book and, you know, what editors I knew that might write about it or writers I knew that might write about it. But the outline in particular is really important because you're really looking at the book throughout, like, you know, from beginning to end, and you want to keep the momentum going throughout the whole outline. So the positive thing is that once you have the outline written, should the book proposal get bought, then, you know, it's already there and you just need to sit down and write it. But as Lori said, you know, it took me a long time to write it. Mine was like 45 pages and I felt it was like the best thing I had ever written until I wrote my book. So, you know, for me, it was like a real kick-ass piece of writing. And I was like, how could somebody not want to publish this book? Because I have such passion. And like, where are you people? Like, you have to share my passion. So, and that's the thing. For me, writing such a title, you know, such a niche of a niche title, like, I just felt so strongly that this book had to be out there that I was willing to, you know, do this book proposal for, you know, like, nobody's paying you to write a book proposal. Nobody's paying you to sit down and, like, do the research. So that's another thing. You really want to have the passion to sustain, you know, covering this topic and writing about this topic and eventually promoting the topic for a long time. And if you don't have it, you know, like, there's so many easier ways to write and make money, you know. So, you know, if your heart is not in it, like, don't write a book. But if your heart is in it, totally write a book. I think, okay. So then once you have your book proposal, then you're like, all right, who's going to publish this? So what I did was I approached through Publishers Marketplace, the thing that I've been subscribing to, I found the name of a publisher, of a guy who I knew had diabetes and published diabetes titles. So I reached out to his assistant and I was like, here's what I want to do. Would you guys be interested? And people don't typically approach publishers directly, but if you have a small title, you know, or a small kind of niche topic, it might make sense to do that if you have a good fit and you know what publisher might be open to you. So that guy was like, sure, I'll take a look. So I sent in the proposal and waited and waited and kind of didn't hear much after like a month or two. And a friend of mine was like, well, you should check in with him, but he doesn't have an exclusive, you know, like, don't waste your time if he's not interested. And I was like, you know, all right. So I, you know, emailed the assistant. The assistant's like, he's still kind of sitting on it. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to approach other people. And she said that was fine. So while I was approaching other people, I eventually heard back from him that he was like, that's too small a market. I don't think I'll make any money. I was like, okay, you're not, you know, you're not my person. I will move on to someone who feels differently. So what I did was I had a list of agents that I'd gotten from an infertility blogger who I'd gotten to know through blogging, who eventually wrote a book of her own about a year before I did. And I reached out to her to ask, you know, sort of what advice she had. And she said, you know, I have this database, or, you know, this Excel spreadsheet of about 60 agents that we're looking at, you know, of agents who are interested in women's health. I can pass it on to you, but it's a year out of date. And I thought, all right. So I basically got this, you know, got this spreadsheet and just started researching every night after my kid went to bed and my husband was in bed. I was up like looking on different websites to see if these agents were still accepting, you know, projects like mine, if they had moved on to other agents or other agencies, and then also how they wanted to receive information. So some people wanted to be contacted by snail mail, which I don't even know if people are still doing that. But, you know, 5 years ago, people were still doing that. Did they want my proposal up front by email? Did they just want, like, an introduction paragraph and then, you know, wait for more information? So I kind of went through this whole list. I also asked every writer I knew if they had an agent that might be interested. And if they did, would they mind if I contacted them and used their name? So of the list of 60, I probably approached about 40 agents. And of the 40, maybe five or six were people that I knew, were friends of friends. And, you know, those people all got back to me and either said no or said, you know, we'll take a look. But the rest of them were just cold, you know, kind of cold calling. But again, like through different sites these sites are on your site. So there's a site called agentquery.com. There's a site called Absolute Right that has very active forums of people talking about their experiences with different agents. And there's a site that I didn't use quite so much, but it's like the Association of Author Representatives. So those are agents who are like, they belong to an association and are considered like credentialed agents, but there are agents that are good that don't necessarily have that credential background. So, you know, so it's a kind of, you know, it's kind of a learning experience to figure out what agent might be the right fit for you. So basically, I just went down the list and, you know, waited to hear back from people. And some people, again, right away were like, too small market, or, you know, I don't have the passion. You know, but a couple of people were like, oh, I might take a look, you know, send me the full proposal, or, you know, let me take a look. So that was just, it was just, you know, kind of a waiting game of, you know, keeping to figure out who was interested and who wasn't. And then finally, one person was like, I think I'm interested. And I was like, hallelujah, like, who is this lady? And this agent, like, she called me. I was sitting in my kitchen. I had this whole long conversation. And I was like, fantastic, you know, like, let me think about this. And I sent her an email the next day saying, you know, I have other book ideas that I might want to do after this book. Would you be interested? You know, it's sort of like a career thing. And immediately she was like, you know, I'm really not the right agent for you. I'm really just interested in this one project. You want a younger, hungrier agent. And I was like, who loses an agent before she even gets an agent? You know, so I was just like, all right, I will move on. But I did take that first agent's interest and emailed whoever I hadn't heard from. And I said, you know, somebody else is interested. Can you let me know? And suddenly I was like Miss Popularity. Suddenly people were like, oh, let me take a look and don't make a decision. And so that was fantastic. So even though like they didn't know this first lady fell through, it got kind of lit a fire under people to actually make a decision. And then ultimately I got to choose between like five agents to who were like, you know, we might be interested or we are interested. But then it was a question of saying, okay, well, this woman is a one woman operation and she's going on maternity leave. I probably don't want to wait. You know, this person wants me to rewrite the entire book with a different voice. I don't want to do that. You know, a third person wanted me to co-write it with a doctor and I didn't want to do that. So I eventually went with the agent who didn't want to change a thing, who liked the proposal the way it was and told me up front that it would, you know, it was a small project. It would not, you know, net me millions. And I said, okay, that will be my next book, which hopefully you'll still be around for. And, you know, and so I went in that direction. This was also around the time when the markets were crashing. So this was like the end of 2008. And the agent was like, you know, I'm going to take this on, but I got to wait until like the markets are doing better because nobody's like buying anything right now. So then, like, I finally got an agent, and then I just had to sit back and wait for, you know, the sort of the financial landscape to change. So it took maybe another 3 or 4 months before she actually started sending this out to publishers. And, you know, I feel like, am I going on and on? Or
No. Right?
Okay. So yeah, so basically the agent then was in the same position that I was. She sent the proposal out, to like 20 different publishers. And again, all of whom were like, you know, she sounds interesting, but too small a market, or we don't like her voice, her voice is too casual, we want something more academic. So, you know, it was like, again, back and forth. And finally, again, hallelujah, you know, like two people were interested, and one, who was the agent or the publisher I signed off on with, was a woman who was like, I love the voice, I love this, you know, I love this, this is great. Where there were a small medical publisher called Demos, which I had never heard of, but it turned out to be the right fit for my book. This editor, it turned out, had gone to my high school, and she was like, Cheryl, you know, we were at Brookline High at the same time, you know, did you hang out on the freak stairs? And I was like, no, I did not hang out on the freak stairs, I was at the library. So clearly our paths had never passed at Brookline High School, but yet, you know, just small world, this woman happened to love my voice and, you know, wanted to champion the book and push it through. So it took, you know, it took a long time. Like I like to say, like it took like 5 years from like the idea when I thought of this book to when it was actually out and being sold. But like along the way, you know, you have to, as I say, you have to have the passion for it, because, you know, you're just not going to stick with it if you only feel lukewarm about it.
Okay, and just one thing I was thinking of while you're speaking, I do get a lot of questions from people, from aspiring writers about, well, do I really need an agent? Shouldn't I just go pitch? In this day and age, can I just go pitch my project? And, you know, I'm never going to say you should absolutely do this or you should do that. I strongly believe that you want to go the agent route. If you believe enough in your project to do all the work, I have a wonderful relationship with my agent. He's quiet when he needs to be. He gives me a pep talk when I need it, when I'm a little burnt out, or, you know, like a year late writing my book because my daughter was born. Things like that, they happen. But you know what? Agents, they have their relationships with the editors. So they know, you know, who's the best fit for a book in a way that I could never know. I can look up who does health and science books for every major publisher, and that's all good and well. But there's this personal relationship that can make a big difference. And obviously, I'm not as comfortable negotiating the way he would be. And so, you know, that's, I have never regretted it. I'm really happy that I have an agent. He's there for the long haul. You know, whatever books I want to write, he wants to help me place them. So, you know, I think that the agent is absolutely an important part of this process. So, I mean, there are sometimes instances where, you know, like Demos, I think, is an example of one where maybe small niche publications will come to you and maybe you're not even agented yet. And so that's a different situation where you maybe want to sit down and think about what you stand to gain. But if you are sort of going a traditional mainstream publishing route, then, you know, there's enough tools out there that you should be able to find who's the right fit for you. And even if it's as low tech as going to the bookstore and looking in the section where the books you like to read are and the books you love on your topic, and looking at the acknowledgments. And if that author has written something glowing about that agent, that says something to you. So you can say, dear so-and-so, you know, I really loved the work that your author, you know, did. And so I think that this project is in that vein. So.
So then once either, you know, whether you've signed with an agent or, you know, the book has sold, then you got to actually sit and write it. So, you know, that's where the benefit of having written a strong outline and a strong proposal comes in, because then you can just look at the outline and be like, all right, here, it's all laid out for me. And for me, you know, it was just, I had developed this list of about 100 names of women with diabetes who wanted to talk about their pregnancies. So every time I had a chapter, I would just like come up with questions, you know, based on what I had said I was going to write about in the proposal, send out my, you know, 100 women, and I'd say, okay, here, I'm collecting answers on these topics or these questions, you know, please respond by this date. And that's how I reported the book, basically. And I also did reach out to some people by phone, and I had about a dozen doctors who are medical experts who I used for the story as well. And it was just, you know, it was just like kind of following the outline. So, and, you know, and really just sitting your ass in the chair and doing it like every day, and knowing that you're, you know, if you have a publisher, then you have, excuse me, you have a deadline, and you know, you don't want to, you know, be late on the deadline, but, though that happens, and it happened with me, but, you know, but the point is, like, as I was writing, I was like, oh yeah, you know, editor who used to hang out at the freak stairs, like, it's taken me about a month to write each chapter, and like the original you know, deadline is not going to fly. And, you know, as it turned out, like, that was okay. Like, my book, it did come out a little late because it, you know, it wasn't passed in late. But I will say, like, it was done exactly the way I wanted it. Like, I had the time to, I had different doctors, like, the doctors that I worked with agreed to review the medical accuracy of everything that I wrote. So I would send out chapters to, like, you know, an OB, an endocrinologist who's a diabetes expert, and an OB nurse that I had worked with when I was having my, you know, my first pregnancy. And they, you know, really were great. And they were like, we're happy to read it through. We're happy, you know, two of them wrote an introduction, you know, and this was based on, like, years of developing, you know, these connections with people as I was trying to get pregnant. But, you know, and also, like, these people were also kind of vested in, like, the success of the book because they felt like a book like this would help their patients and, you know, would, you know, in this tiny way, make their jobs easier, you know, just to, like, have a resource to show to their patients. So that's really it, you know, just like making sure you get the work done and like giving yourself enough time to do it the way you want to do, because nobody's going to care about your book as much as you do, you know. So, you know, having been an editor, you know, and I've dealt with writers who are late, and I've always been like, why can't they just meet the deadline, you know? And now I was like, oh, I see why they can't meet the deadline. Like, you know, life happens. So, you know, as long as you are, you know, upfront and, you know, and you are, again, committed to producing the best work possible, you know, and giving yourself the adequate time to do it, you know, that it will get done.
Yeah, so, you know, Cheryl said you just have to sit in the chair and write, correct? But easier said than done. But no, I mean, you have to make sacrifices. You're going to miss out on other parts of your life unless you get an amazing advance and you can stop everything else you're doing. Maybe that'll be the next book.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this is really where the value of that network that we've been telling you to cultivate comes into play, because, you know, for my first book, it was very anecdotal. It was my experiences, about 5 or 6 other patients, and it was about sort of navigating the medical establishment, the professional world, and relationships. So I already knew who I wanted to interview because I've been writing for and with these people. I knew that they had their own network, so there was some built-in incentive for them to promote the book because their story was in it. And I continued to grow with that. So by the time I was writing my second book, which has a 17-page reference list and was a beast to research, it was just totally different type of book. I knew who to interview. When I needed a public health expert, I could put it out on Twitter and say, on deadline, who can talk to me? And I found people that way. When I wanted to go over Pew research information, I direct messaged Susanna Fox over at Pew, said, hey, I've got your study. Can I ask you a question on it? So it's really, like, it made writing it so much easier, even though I had this plan, which I radically departed from. So don't be afraid of that. My book originally was supposed to be thematic, and it is not chronological, which is a big change. So don't be afraid. It's a roadmap, but it's not set in stone. And sometimes you need the space to really let ideas sort of digest and start over. But if you have this network, then you have patients to interview, have experts that you know. They're feeding you information. And then when we get to the last major topic about being your own publicist, they're built in with an investment in helping you get your book out there. But really, when you're writing about any sort of health topic, you really need to keep this idea of audience in mind. So, for example, my second book is very research dense, but I didn't want it to be academic. If I had wanted an academic book, I could have done that, and that's not what I was going for. So I was really careful about word choice, and anytime I could use a more familiar term for a medical issue, I would, even if it's something as similar as heart attack versus cardiovascular event, something like that. But what I also really was conscious about was bringing in the narrative details and the personal stories, because I think that is really what connects people. And if you're writing about health, oftentimes you're trying to engage other patients. Maybe they want to be able to say, hey, this resonated. Hey, this validated my experiences. So even though my second book was, you know, is very research dense, every chapter opens with a patient narrative, with details about a person that the reader can hopefully become invested in, and that sort of opens up the themes of the rest of the chapter. And I think that, you know, that personal, those kinds of details, if you're not trying to do something that's totally scientific or academic, really make a big difference, because at the end of the day, you need to tell a good story. No matter what you're writing, you owe it to your reader to tell a good story. So I think oftentimes with these projects, it's that sort of narrative and perspective on, personal perspective on a health topic that really can tie a lot of themes together. So
And you know what? There was one thing I was just gonna say. Now I can't remember what it was.
Voice.
Yeah. You know. I guess that's the same thing. That you know, I had written this book based on, you know, like a lot of other women who I'd found online, and I was very kind of casual, and I was not academic at all about writing, because I was like, these books already exist, and I don't want another dry topic book about what's terrible about, you know, being pregnant with diabetes. I want it to be, you know, kind of uplifting and hopeful, and like, you know, we're all in this together, but we're going to get through. And my publisher, or excuse me, my agent came back and said, you know, I sent this out to a number of academic publishers, and they were like, this is too bloggy, it's too kind of girly, you know, like, and it's like, what's more girly than pregnancy? But I mean, you know, they wanted it to be more academic, and I was like, that is not my book, you know. So like, really, if you can, if you have someone who's in there who's like, I'm going to push this through, you know, stay true to your voice, and you know, and be authentic, because you know, that's probably, there's something in you that wants to tell this story, and you know, as Lori said, like, you want to tell a good story, so you know, stay true to your voice.
Good. Yeah, in the interest of time, I think we're going to move on to what I always find the most fun part of writing a book, also the most stressful, which is being your own publicist. And in this day and age, yes, you're expected to do a lot more. Mm-hmm. I'm 99% certain the only reason I even got my first book deal at 25 was because I went on at length and pages in my book proposal about all the things I was going to do for them. They were like, oh. Okay, she gets it. We'll give her marching orders. So, but I was young and eager, and I felt like I had this platform, so that's really all I can offer, right? So, being your own publicist is really important. And I think with health topics, you have the advantage of having news hooks and timely issues. You know, there's Disease Awareness Month, there's late-breaking research and innovations that get publicized. So those are great, and you can use those to your advantage, but health topics are also evergreen, right? So what I'm writing today about social media and public health is going to be relevant in a year. So I've already got speaking engagements for next May for a book that came out a year ago, because topics are still evergreen. So I think you need to take a short-term view and a long-term, and they're completely different strategies for that. So the short-term view is, okay, what are you going to do leading up to pub, right? Pub date. You really need to build a blitz. So 6 weeks or so leading up to and after pub date is when everything pops. So you want to time it. And publishers will still do, they do a really good job with the traditional stuff. So they'll pitch NPR, and they'll pitch, you know, they'll get you reviewed in Kirkus and all of that. But you're going to be doing a lot of the other stuff. So I set up, for example, my pub date was in April. And from mid-March through the end of May, I had a virtual blog tour where almost every day somewhere on the internet, somebody was doing something with my book. And I had it in Google Drive, and I sent it off, and everyone knew what they were doing and where. And it was a lot of work, because sometimes, you know, I would be doing all the Q&As, but after a while, you begin, you know, you can use some of the same answers and change them a little bit. And people would do reviews, which was fabulous. People would do interviews. People would do giveaways on their blogs. And so it was a way for me to get my book to all these other people that maybe I wasn't reaching personally. And that was actually a big part of my publicity campaign. That was something from day one that my whole team knew I was in charge of. Other things that I did, I reached out, and anytime anyone writing a similar book wanted a blurb or wanted me to do something on my blog, if I read the book and I thought it was good, then I started nurturing those relationships too. And so when it came time to get those advance quotes, I had people that I felt comfortable with and whose perspective really, really added. The other big thing is timing clips and bylines, right? For right around publication. I always tell my students when they read an op-ed to look at the byline, because odds are the author has a book that has just come out or is coming out. So for me, for example, I was really interested in gender and pain. It's a big part of my second book. And I noticed this random study that a short news article in the New York Times covered about how researchers were cutting the dose of Ambien for women. And it was this whole issue, larger issue, of how men and women are dosed differently, or their bodies metabolize drugs differently, but all drugs are really tested on the average white male. So I took that, and it related to my topic on gender and pain, and I used the news hook to write an op-ed, and I said, hey, New York Times, what do you guys think? And they published it 3 weeks before my pub date, which was huge. I mean, it opened up a whole different level of publicity. It didn't have to be there, though. I mean, the point is, it didn't have to be the New York Times. You got to start somewhere. Point is, take those news hooks. Be an informed reader. Be a discerning reader. And anytime you see something that you can capitalize on and open up and talk about your book, jump. Because people need clips. I mean, publishers, editors, they need content. Stuff every day.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, as I was saying, like those Google alerts, you know, that you're hopefully you've already set up, you know, will maybe tell you that some celebrity has just announced that they are diabetes, you know, that they have pregnant or they have diabetes, and you know, Halle Berry is having her second baby, and it's like, oh, Halle Berry, diabetic, you know, maybe I can connect there, or you know, like some, you know, some celebrity on Twitter is talking about, you know, something, then you can like reach out to them directly. That it's a long shot, but you know, you just never know where something's, you know, where something's going to hit. There's also, so for publicity stuff, I had also said, you know, join Yahoo groups, or you know, join groups on LinkedIn where people are talking about your topic, or you know, whatever you know you're interested in. And you know, if it's, you know, there's some LinkedIn groups that are kind of, they seem to be a lot of amateurs, but you know, if there are people who seem to know what they're talking about, jump into the conversation and, you know, position yourself as someone who knows what you're talking about. And it's just another way to sort of build your brand. And then, you know, those people could be perhaps interested in promoting your book. Also, there's a, so, oh, and you know, like even just like something as simple as setting up the signature block on your email to say that you are the author of the upcoming book, or, you know, the link to the Amazon page or your publisher's page, you know, or if you've set up a Facebook page for your book, you know, just a way to kind of just keep imprinting yourself on people's brains as like as the author of this particular book. Another thing I did, there's a woman named Sandra Beckwith, and her site, her company is called Beckwith Communications, and her, I believe her stuff is on the handout. She is a longtime book publicist, and she does, I think it's a 6-week online course of like self-publicity, you know, or publicity for book authors. And I had kind of known a lot of this stuff, but I did take her course, and I want to say it's like $79 or $100. Like it's worth it, and it just gives you more detail of like how you can position yourself. Like, you know, is there a, you know, not November is Diabetes Month. You know, is there some kind of day or a month that's like applicable to your, you know, to what you're writing about that you can pitch yourself to people as an expert or someone to be interviewed about. You know, again, before or after your book comes out. And, you know, for me, the point is, like, you really never stop promoting yourself. You know, again, for, you know, such a niche topic as myself, like, I can't rely on, you know, bestseller lists. Like, I just have to find the people who I know need my book and then, you know, let it be known that, you know, the source is out there and that, you know, there's a way for them to get more information by buying the book. So, I think, you know, just in terms of, you know, my final, you know, thing to you is, you know, really never stop promoting the book and never stop, you know, being passionate about what it is that you're writing about. Anything else?
Yeah, no, and I think that's right about where we were hoping to end for Q&A, because we love that part of things. So, do you guys have questions? Yes. If you're self-publishing?
Yeah, should we repeat the question, or should you?
Oh, okay.
Do you want to ask it again with the microphone, just so everyone can hear it?
Sorry. For self-publish, do you use your business name or your personal name? How do you promote your book? Your own personal name?
I mean, I haven't self-published, but I don't have a business name. I'm a longtime writer, and I just write under my byline, which is Cheryl Alcon. So I would promote myself as Cheryl Alcon. But I don't know what the benefit would be if you have a business name already. It's just how do you want to be the book to be known, like through your business or through your byline? That'd be my answer.
Yeah, I would say what if you're building a platform and you're trying, and you've already sort of tried to get momentum, I would go with whatever is going to be consistent. But.
So did you self-publish?
No. So both my first and second books were both through Walker, which is an imprint of Bloomsbury, USA. So.
I've been working on a memoir, actually. I'm doing the writing first, and I'm working with a writing mentor. But my question is, is there something to be said for not getting pieces of your book out there in terms of personal essays? And how do publishers look upon that? Do they sometimes think, oh, this person hasn't published essays or anything, and I'd rather work with that? Somebody new, a new name, you know, giving them an opportunity.
My my sense is that it is an advantage if you can do that because it shows publishers that other people are interested in it. Even if it's not, you know, copy and pasted, it's actually an excerpt mm-hmm. from your book. But if it's an essay about the same type of thing. So for my first book, I wrote an essay about disclosing illness to my now husband. And it was published in Coupling, and it was a good fit for Coupling. But then I could take that and put it in my book proposal and say, look, this issue of relationships and illness resonates. So, I mean, it doesn't mean you can't get a book deal without it, but I think it really is an advantage.
Yeah, and actually, I should have said, too, I think with memoir, you are supposed to write the whole thing first. So even though it's not fiction yet, I haven't written a memoir. But yeah, I would say the same thing. I mean, you know, I don't know whether it would make sense to do it like a direct excerpt, you know, from your book versus, you know, just like topics about, you know, essays about the same topic. But yeah, I would agree with Lori that it shows that other people are interested in your writing.
Save the excerpt for 3 weeks before a pub date and put it on Salon. That's what you should do with the excerpt.
I'm curious about sort of the different tricks and different hazards that you come across when writing about health in particular. But I'm just curious because when you talk about public health, it's usually in big statistics, and how do you relate those statistics back down to a personal level? And then when you are talking about different scientific studies, how do you report on them in a way that's both accurate and interesting? Because I often come across like health writing, and I'm like, well, that's cool, but is that really what the researchers were saying there? What about confounding variables, different things like that?
Okay, that's an awesome question. And you're prepping me for when I deal with my science writing students on public writing in a month, right? So I say anytime you can use a relatable example, I mean, that's kind of obvious, but it really makes a big difference. So when I was writing my second book, I tried to use diseases as sort of case studies of a larger issue. So if I was looking at gender and pain, and there's a lot of research on the difference in communication, for example, between men and women, and the differences in the perception of pain and physiological differences in the way people who are given stimuli respond, right? And it gets a little technical. It's not as technical as, say, pharmacology, but so I can talk about that, but I do that within the context of a patient's story going mm-hmm. through this. And I think in terms of how much do you bring in with the studies themselves, you need to understand that so that you're giving a fair and balanced view. I think in the context of a book, you really need to ask yourself, why should the reader care? What will the reader care? You know, what do they need to know about the study for it to resonate? Do they need to know how the data was quantified? Probably not. But do they need to know where it sits within the body of existing literature? Absolutely. So I think that one thing that I see a lot of that is troubling is, you know, new research out about heart attacks and aspirin with no nod to what was already there and where this is moving it forward. So I think that that is a really important thing to keep in mind.
And also, I think if you're reporting on something, you know, like kind of ask the researcher, you know, like why, you know, how is your research different than, you know, what's already out there? You know, like maybe even ask the researcher, maybe ask like, you know, a colleague of the researchers, you know, or maybe not someone who directly knows a researcher, but, you know, to get the balance and the perspective so that it's not just the latest and greatest, but like, you know, the latest and greatest in the bigger picture.
And people love to talk about their research, so don't feel shy. The worst that's going to happen is they don't write back, but... researchers love. I mean, this is what they do, and mm-hmm. they are excited that people care. So it's great to actually mm-hmm. get some contextual analysis from them, too. Mm-hmm. So,
Cheryl, what was the name of the expert for publicizing yourself? I think you mentioned
Sandra Beckwith, and her site, it's Beckwith, it's Beckwith Communications. She's out of, I think, Long Island.
Great, thank you.
Sure.
Hello. I really enjoy both your perspectives. I want to know what if you could share your technique and how you went about in interviewing the patients and doctors. For example, did you have a consent form? And did you record? Or how did you go in that process and transcripts? And second is... did they expect payment? I'm just curious, like, what happens afterwards? Thanks.
You want me to start?
Sure.
Okay. Well, I mean, I didn't pay anyone. Like, and I got a very small advance. So frankly, I had no money to pay anyone. Nobody should expect any payment. You know, I mean, like, and I've worked in journalism a long time. Like, I've never had to pay anyone to talk to me. You know, like, they should want to talk to you because they want to, you know, share their story and, you know, create, you know, contribute to a larger, you know, project about the topic. You know, and as I had said, like, I, you know, was blogging for a long time. I went on websites where I knew people were talking about diabetes and pregnancy. And like I just said, you know, and I on my blog, you know, said I'm always looking to talk to people if you're interested in contributing to my book. And, you know, people emailed me, like, you know, out of nowhere. But I also would go on to, like, bulletin boards where people were talking about it, and I would reach out to the people who ran the bulletin boards, and I'd say, listen, I'm writing this book. I'm looking for people. Do you mind if I post something? Because, you know, some bulletin board owners, like, they don't want to get commercial. They don't want, excuse me, media people, like, infiltrating what should be a patient site. So I always got permission before I posted something. And then for doctors, you know, like, I had worked with a bunch of doctors, and, you know, I've done a lot of health writing, so I kind of knew where to find the people. But I also, another site we haven't mentioned is PubMed, which is a site of, like, all, it's a collection of all the, like, research journals that are out there that are publishing. So it's PubMed, I think it's PubMed.com, but then it, like, bounces to something. It's run by the NIH. And you can just type in, you know, diabetes and cord blood collection, you know, which was kind of an esoteric topic that I was covering. And I found one guy out of Florida who was, you know, doing research on this. And I emailed him directly and said, can I interview you for my book? And, you know, like Lori said, like, researchers love to talk about their stuff. So, you know, I didn't have any problem reaching people at all.
You guys have not actually brought me to tears. I was something in my eyes, so sorry about that. I was something in my contact, distracting me. I mean, my process was somewhat similar. You know, I lined up, for my second book, I had more interviews and I had more research. So I sort of approached them in separate tracks. So for the research, I annotated probably 75 books. It was a long time. I collected journal articles. I actually just had everything saved electronically in my Gmail folders because that just worked for me. But I had this one master document with, you know, sort of all my annotations and what chapters I thought they were going to speak to. I did a ton of online research. And then my interviews, you know, I interviewed people over the course, multiple times over the course of 2 years, sometimes three, actually, because I started with my sample chapter for my book proposal. And I really went with whatever worked best for my interviewee. So some people love to just talk on the phone. So in that case, I would always ask permission, and I recorded it. You know, I just put my phone on speaker and use my iPhone, my voice memo, and they're all on my computer now, and went through and transcribed what I needed to. Some people, especially if you're working with patients, you know, with different limitations or issues, maybe really prefer to speak and use Dragon and then just send everything over email, mm-hmm. then clarify that way. Sometimes if I was lucky enough to be near the person, I met them in person, and that's always wonderful to have that. So you really have to go with whatever is best for them, and just be really organized about mm-hmm. it, and mm-hmm. you know, don't be afraid to do follow-ups and clarify. And you know, I've never had anyone, you know, if they say yes to begin with, then they're in it, mm-hmm. you know, they're all in. And if they just say, you know what, I love it, but I just don't have time, mm-hmm. then usually they can point you to someone else that might be able to answer your question. But
microphone.
I guess I have kind of a similar question with regards to doing the research in HIPAA. Did that come into play at all when you were developing your stories?
I mean, that's a great question. I think I did have a couple. Yeah, well, I did have one person who answered under a pseudonym mm-hmm. in my book for professional reasons. He was worried about his job. And I did interview someone who is a very well-known blogger who blogs under a pseudonym. So I referred to him as Duncan Cross throughout because that was his blog. Mm-hmm. You know, basically, if someone is granting the interview, then, you know, what we talk about, they're giving me permission. So I would mm-hmm. never share anything that I didn't find out from them or anything mm-hmm. like that. But certainly, you know, it is important to keep HIPAA in mind and in privacy. So if there's ever any doubt, I say, you know, double check with the person mm-hmm. and make sure that they're comfortable sharing it. A lot of times I found patients are really, really excited to talk about their experience because they hope that maybe it can shed some light for someone else. So. Mm-hmm.
And I found that too. I interviewed about 50 women for my book, and I would say probably 48 of them were done through emails. And it was just like the same, you know, from some of the people in my book, the same people responded to every chapter, and there were 9 chapters. Some, it was just like one, you know, one time thing. And some of them did want to only be identified by their first name. Like one woman who gave like the, what I felt was like the most harmless quote about something was like, oh no, don't even put my name in there. So I think there's like one woman who didn't want her name, but the rest of them were like, sure. And I said, you know, if they were like John Smith from, or, you know, not Jane Smith from Boston, like, you know, I said, it's okay if I, you know, identify where you're from, because I wanted to show that these were real women. And most said that that was fine, but it was a real range, you know, and all the doctors, you know, were fine being quoted as who they were. But yeah, I didn't run into HIPAA issues at all. I just figured like if they were talking to me, you know, about what they were talking about, they were fine.
Another question?
Okay, yeah, we're getting a note for one last question.
All right, well, thank you all so much for coming out. Great questions.